extend 2 510 848 3812, or email us at calendar@kpfa.org. Attention to the community calendar. Tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To hear this calendar again, call 510-848-6767 extension 621. The calendar is also online at kpfa.org.
And it's 12 noon. You're listening to KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, and KFCF in Fresno, and we're online at kpfa.org. Please stay tuned now for Against the Grain.
Today on Against the Grain, what role does torture play in the projection of U.S. power? Is torture used sparingly, or is it widely promoted both abroad and on U.S. soil? And are there any circumstances under which torture is justified? I'm C.S. Song. I'll talk with the author of American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination, after these news headlines with Sandra Lupien.
The U.S. House of Representatives is gearing up for a vote today on legislation to fund the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the war in Afghanistan while setting a timeline to bring U.S. troops home from Iraq. Democrats are predicting the $124 billion supplemental spending bill will pass. Its terms have already been agreed to by Senate negotiators, and the Senate vote is expected tomorrow. The bill will probably reach President Bush's desk by early next week. He has vowed to veto it. The measure orders that U.S. combat troops begin to come home from Iraq by October of this year and sets a non-binding deadline of April 1st of next year for withdrawal of a large number of combat troops from Iraq. The United Nations criticized Iraq's government today for not disclosing politically sensitive figures about civilian deaths and injuries, and said the humanitarian crisis there is rapidly worsening. The United Nations Assistance Mission in Iraq said Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's government has withheld data on civilian deaths. Despite the difficulties in obtaining accurate information, the UN said that more than 34,000 Iraqi civilians were killed and more than 36,000 wounded last year. Maliki issued a statement rejecting the UN report as unbalanced. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice could be the latest Bush administration official to come under congressional scrutiny. The House Oversight Committee voted today to issue a subpoena to Rice to compel her story on the Bush administration's claim, now discredited, that Iraq was seeking uranium from Africa. The claim was a key argument by the administration to drum up U.S. support for the invasion of Iraq. Meanwhile, in the most recent development in the controversy surrounding the administration's firings last year of 8 federal prosecutors, the House Judiciary Committee voted to grant immunity to Monica Goodling, Attorney General Gonzalez's White House liaison, for her testimony. The panel also unanimously approved, but did not issue, a subpoena to compel her to appear. And across Capitol Hill, the Senate Judiciary Committee approved, but did not issue, a subpoena on the prosecutor's matter to Sarah Taylor. She's the deputy to Presidential Advisor Karl Rove. The House Oversight Committee also issued subpoenas for the Republican National Committee for testimony and documents about White House emails on RNC accounts that have apparently gone missing in violation of the law. The California Assembly Public Safety Committee has approved a bill that would abolish California's troubled youth prison system by January 1, 2009. AB 1655 by Mountain View Democrat Sally Lieber would fundamentally change the way in which the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation manages and rehabilitates its youth offender population. AB 1655 proposes to shift wards out of DJJ youth prisons to smaller community-based facilities that would be administered by counties, not the state prison system. This would place young people in secure therapeutic facilities that are close to their family and other support systems. Oakland Mayor Ron Dellums and City Council President Ignacio de la Fuente will make a joint announcement this afternoon opposing federal immigration raids. The two are expected to affirm that the police department and other city agencies will not cooperate with any federal immigration investigation, detention, or arrest procedures unless the situation involves public safety or serious crimes. A statement from his office says Dellums is working on a resolution calling for a moratorium on federal immigration raids and the passage of fair, comprehensive, and humane federal immigration reforms. Over the weekend, San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom pledged to maintain that city as a sanctuary for undocumented immigrants. Concord's City Council has postponed a vote to certify its rejection of an environmental impact report for a major big box development in that city. Certifying the vote would have blocked the Walmart Lowe's-anchored Jones Ranch project from moving ahead. On March 6th, the council voted to reject the EIR, and citizens groups No Moron 4 had expected the council members to certify that vote last night. No Moron 4 today expressed disappointment at the decision to delay the vote until September. No Moron 4 says it fears the developer is influencing the council. And after 2 hours of emotional testimony from residents of the towns surrounding the ConocoPhillips refinery in Rodeo, the Contra Costa County Planning Commission decided to continue its hearing on a proposed expansion of that refinery for 2 weeks. Public testimony will continue at that time. The Planning Commission had been expected to vote last night. But the group Communities for a Better Environment says the oil company should first take preventive measures to stop pollution that results from flaring. The environmental group says ConocoPhillips is the only Bay Area refiner with no dedicated system in place to recover flare gases. And that's it for news this hour. News returns at 3:30 with Free Speech Radio News, headlines at 4 o'clock, and I hope you'll join us for the hour-long KPFA evening news at 6. I'm Sandra Lupien. Stay tuned for Against the Grain.
You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Abu Ghraib put torture in the headlines. But how often is torture practiced when it's not in the news? Torture is used, we're told, to extract intelligence that saves lives. But how effective is torture as a means of obtaining credible, essential information? Torture is often associated with Alberto Gonzalez's legal opinions and with George W. Bush's unapologetic disregard for the Geneva Conventions. But how long has torture and violation of international law been a preferred method of the U.S. military and of domestic law enforcement? Christian Williams has carefully investigated the U.S. government's use of torture in war, in prison, and by proxy. The result is a book entitled American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination, published by South End Press. Christian Williams' work has appeared in publications like Counterpunch and In These Times. He's also author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. He joins us now by phone from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to you.
Hello.
Hi. Torture takes place in certain situations when certain conditions are present, and you write that at Abu Ghraib, contributing factors included flawed procedures, inadequate classification of prisoners, a shortage of staff, too high of a prisoner-to-staff ratio, misleading or vague instructions from superiors. Two other important factors you point to are racism and dehumanization. How did those two factors set the stage for torture?
Well, the torture that we saw in the famous photographs was largely a practice of dehumanization. In that sense, it was a continuation of a process that began much, much earlier, both in the minds of the interrogators and the guards, and also in the treatment of the prisoners themselves. So, you know, looking at the one trajectory, there's the process by which most of the people who were being held in the prison came to be there, which generally involved either broad sweeps, just arbitrarily rounding up, you know, dozens of people on the street, putting them, cuffing them, throwing them in the back of the truck, dragging them to the prison, taking them out, cutting off their clothes, a very rudimentary and, in many fields, degrading medical exam, fingerprints, photographs, and then throwing them in a cell, basically with no explanation. Or it involved house raids, which, you know, follows much the same course, except it involved soldiers breaking down the door, usually in the middle of the night, forcing everybody to the ground at gunpoint, et cetera. So the dehumanizing process, as the prisoners experience it, begins basically immediately with their contact with the American troops. And the it's very easy to sort of view the torture at Abu Ghraib as an extension of the same kind of treatment that they were already undergoing. From the other side, there was the general sort of indoctrination of nationalism and viewing the Iraqi population as sort of a generic other, as Haji, that was very much a part of the military culture overall, and specifically at Abu Ghraib, and was and which you can also see in the more lofty sort of theory behind the interrogation of Arab prisoners in particular, and the very condescending sort of assumptions about Arab culture and the use of things like sexual humiliation and intimidation with dogs as being, particularly effective against people from the Middle East, as, mm-hmm. as though, civilized European people aren't, terrified of growling, barking, snarling dogs. There's very much a sort of implicit racist assumption that it was the weakness or the foibles of the indigenous population there in Iraq that made them susceptible to these kinds of abuses.
Now, for those people who support torture in certain circumstances, the scenario that's often brought up is interrogation, that torture can be used during interrogation to get valuable information from the suspect and possibly save lives. Was torture used in connection with interrogation at Abu Ghraib?
Certainly it was, but that wasn't the only use that it had. And in fact, it was kind of a minor use. The interrogators were in break with earlier military precedent. The interrogators were basically given authority over the guards, which knocked down a very important check on the treatment of prisoners, because the idea, under the Geneva Conventions, is that prisoners are deserving of a certain level of treatment, period. And they can be asked questions, they can be interrogated, but they can't, their refusal to cooperate or their cooperation can't have any significant repercussions for them, either positive or negative. So, how much sleep they get, how often they eat, their housing conditions, all of that stuff is supposed to be just a given, and the interrogation is supposed to be separate. Now, by giving the interrogators authority of the guards, it basically gave the interrogators the ability to determine whether and how much sleep the prisoners got, whether and how much they were given to eat and when, what the temperature in their cells was going to be, whether the lights were ever going to come on, whether the lights were always going to be on, all of the total conditions under which the prisoners lived were turned over to the interrogators. And that was very deliberate policy that was actually brought to Abu Ghraib from Guantanamo by General Jeffrey Miller. So there was definitely a close link between the use of torture at Abu Ghraib and the interrogations. However, there were also abuses documented which had no connection to the interrogation at all, and that were simply sadistic, simply terroristic, and were abuses leveled against people who were known at the time to have no information of any real intelligence value.
Were known at the time?
Yeah. The according to one of the military intelligence officers at Abu Ghraib, he told the Red Cross that approximately 90% of the people who were held in the prison at the time of the abuses that were reported on in the scandal were picked up by mistake. So the military intelligence's own estimate was that 90% of the people who were in prison had no business being in prison at all. And but then there was a major sort of inertia of how you process them out. So like the U.S. was very adept at grabbing people and putting them in cells, and very, very slow, very reticent to let them go again, even after the authorities were convinced that, you know, this guy's a taxi driver, he just happened to be at the checkpoint.
Christian Williams is author of American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination. He's also a member of Rose City Cop Watch in Portland, Oregon, where he has helped to document cases of police brutality and has trained dozens of people on their rights when dealing with the cops. He's also appeared, his work has appeared in the collection We Are Everywhere, The Irresistible Rise of Global Anti-Capitalism. He joins us on Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. What has been established, Christian, about the tendency of someone who's being tortured to say what they think their torturer wants to hear, regardless of whether it's true or not?
This is a very well-established fact, and it's been understood for since basically forever, since antiquity. I actually quote Aristotle making the argument that torture is not a very effective way to gain information because some people are going to be able to resist it no matter what you do to them, and some people are going to say absolutely anything, whether it's true or not, in order to make the pain stop. So there's that. There's also the fact that even people who may have the information you're looking for, when they're subject to intense and especially prolonged pain, their ability to report it degrades very quickly. The pain makes it harder for them to tell truth from fiction. It makes it harder for them to remember details. It makes it harder for them to communicate even the things that they do remember. All of this has been established both by psychological studies and also we've learned it by the reports of interrogators who have used the techniques. And for that reason, like any serious interrogation manual that you will read will have long and firm advice against introducing any of the pain or humiliation into the interrogation because it doesn't produce the information that is useful.
You pose the question of why we need rules at all, why we need rules against torture. That is, what sort of person needs a rule to tell him or her not to torture? And then you bring up a series of experiments conducted by a social psychologist named Stanley Milgram, I think in the 60s and 70s. What did those experiments reveal about obedience to authority, for example?
This is actually probably the most disturbing thing that I came across in my research for this book. And the Milgram experiments were really ingeniously simple. He had volunteers come into the office at Yale, and he gave them the situation where they were going to be asked to deliver electric shocks of increasing voltage to another volunteer. And the premise was that they were going to be experimenting on whether pain affected the memory. But in fact, what they were doing was they were testing whether people would in fact deliver these shocks. And the volunteer who was supposed to be electrocuted was in fact an actor, and you know nobody was actually hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And what they thought would happen is that people would just refuse and walk out. And that they could then find the, you know, relative minority who would go along with it, and then they could study the traits of those people and figure out why it is that some people behave participate in atrocities. And what they found instead is that the overwhelming majority of adult Americans would administer the shocks, would at least administer the first few. And the main conclusion that they made was that the tendency to obey authority is overdeveloped in adults in the United States. And they did the experiment hundreds of times. It's been reproduced surely thousands of times. And they've isolated certain factors to make it more likely that people will obey, like entering into a situation of authority and subordination, and the presence of the scientist. They found that if the scientist leaves the room, the tendency to obey goes down like immediately. Really what they found was that most Americans put in a situation where somebody with a lab coat and a clipboard tells them to electrocute an avowedly innocent person will do it. And that I think part of, so to bring that back around, part of why we need a rule against torture is so that when there are, soldiers or intelligence officers or cops or whoever who are in a position where their commander is telling them to do something that their conscience says is wrong, that the whole weight of authority is not on the side of the torturer, that there is this institutional norm that they can point to that will help sort of help them protect themselves from being morally exploited by their commanders.
Kristen Williams joins us by phone from Portland, Oregon, author of American Methods. We have links to that book of his, as well as to his previous book, Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, on our website, againstthegrain.org. We're going to take a short music break, and since the phone connection isn't that good, Christian, I'd like you to hang up the phone, and I'd also like you to stand by both your landline and your cell phone, and we will call you back, probably starting with your cell phone, and please stay tuned.
Okay.
And you are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song, and the associate producer of Against the Grain is Jen Angel. Christian Williams is our guest today. He is a writer for many publications. He is a member of Rose City Cop Watch in Portland, and he is author most recently of American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination, published by South End Press. Well, I'm just trying to figure out where to go here. There's so much in this book to talk about, and we should say that although the book is a little over 200 pages, Christian Williams has 750 endnotes so the reader can check out his sources. The book carefully documents everything. His book maps the connections between the practices of the torture chamber and larger systems of power, especially imperialism, racism, and male dominance. So, you know, we've got these Geneva Conventions, right, don't we, Christian? And they were written in 1949, following, of course, the end of World War II. They govern the treatment of prisoners, specifically list types of treatment that are prohibited. What kinds of activities do U.S. personnel engage in that are prohibited by the Geneva Conventions?
Well, as I was saying before, the sort of Guantanamo system of putting the overall conditions of the prisoner at the hands of the interrogators is exactly the sort of thing that the Geneva Conventions meant to eliminate. So, for example, in Guantanamo Bay, the idea is that once you're there, you have nothing. You have no right to, you know, anything at all. And that if you want, you know, hot water, if you want hot food, if you want to be let to sleep through the night, if you want to be given something other than an orange jumpsuit to wear, if you want a Quran, if you want a prayer mat, if you want any of that, the only way to get it is to cooperate with the interrogators. And the and so there's this gradated system where prisoners are supposed to earn their way up toward the privilege camp, and if they cease to cooperate, or if the interrogator feels like they need a little bit more pressure, they can, at a moment's notice, be knocked back down into the punishment cells. And the Geneva Conventions explicitly say that neither incentives nor punishments can be administered based on a prisoner's willingness to cooperate with interrogation or refusal to cooperate. That's a particularly good example because it's so institutionalized, and it is, you know, there's no debate about whether or not that's happening, and there's no debate about whether or not the authorities have authorized it. The place where there is a debate is whether or not the Geneva Conventions apply in Guantanamo Bay. The other things, of course, like any of the prolonged solitary confinement, any of the physical abuse, any of the sexual humiliation, any of the taking photographs of prisoners for sort of trophy purposes, all of that also violates the explicit rules of the Geneva Conventions. Holding family members basically as hostages to convince other people to, you know, suspect a terrorist to either turn themselves in or to cooperate with interrogation, that is explicitly prohibited. It's also something that the U.S. is doing with marked frequency in Iraq.
You cite the assumption held by many people that the lawlessness of the Bush administration is unique, George W. Bush's administration is unique, and that it's the product of the attacks of September 11th, 2001. What should we know about lawlessness? And I'm speaking here in the context of torture and its allowability. What should we know about lawlessness in the administrations of George Bush Sr. and of Bill Clinton?
Well, the current Bush administration is more bold than its predecessors in this regard, but it hasn't actually marked out much new ground. I mean, to take a particularly clear case that has been in the news recently, the Extraordinary Rendition Program, where members of the United States intelligence agencies go to some other country and kidnap a person that they want off the street, hood them, shackle them, drug them, put them on an airplane, fly them to yet another country where they will be interrogated using, you know, whatever methods that other country thinks are appropriate, usually the most brutal available. This was formalized by Bill Clinton and was, you know, inherited by, Bush inherited the infrastructure for this. And it's been, it seems as though it's been, you know, it's a secret program, so it's hard to say with much certainty how extensive or not it is. It seems as though it's gotten more prevalent under the Bush administration, but it wasn't his invention by any means. Similarly, if you look at the training and funding and arming of torturers in other countries, the pattern there is pretty stable and goes back for, you know, decades. And the thing that's changed is which countries get the training and the arms and the funding. And it tends to be whoever is, you know, putting down a left-wing insurgency at the moment. So, you know, aside from Israel and Egypt, who have been the two biggest recipients in this regard since 1979, in the 80s, it was El Salvador. In the 90s, it was Turkey and then Colombia. And the thing that all of those have in common is that they were fighting a guerrilla war using especially nasty tactics.
Tell us what happened to a German citizen named Khaled El-Masri. He was detained on New Year's Eve 2003. I think he was on the border of Macedonia. This is in relation to extraordinary rendition. What happened to him?
He was detained presumably because his name resembled somebody who was on some sort of terrorist watch list. And interestingly, the border guards who detained him were pretty sure at the time that it was a mistake. Nevertheless, they, you know, contacted their superiors. They went through the channels. He was arrested. He was held in a blacked-out hotel room for some few days. And then he was turned over to people that he thinks were Americans, flown to some undisclosed location, brutally tortured, and then released weeks later in, if I remember right, Albania, to find his way home. During that time, his family had no idea where he was. His wife, he had left in the middle of an argument with his wife, and she thought that he had abandoned the family. It was really a pretty sad story all around.
Yeah, I'm reading from your book. One interrogator told El-Masri, "You are here in a country where no one knows about you, in a country where there is no law. If you die, we will bury you, and no one will know." And he was released in Albania in May 2004. Torture warrants. Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz has pushed the idea of torture warrants, which I guess could be analogized in a technical way to search warrants, right? So before you torture somebody, you have to go in front of a panel, perhaps, or a single administrative judge or something like that to obtain a warrant before doing the dirty deed. What do you think of this idea?
It's a terrible idea. I spend a lot of the third chapter talking about specifically this idea and the numerous problems with it. I mean, it's such a bad idea that it's hard to know where to begin. For one thing, Dershowitz seems to assume that if torture is regulated, if it is occasionally authorized, then the routine illicit occurrences of it will go down, which seems just prima facie absurd. For one thing, there's no reason to think that people who are already breaking the law using torture are going to stop breaking the law using torture when just because there's a legally available means for them to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it would seem to introduce a sort of ambiguity around the whole area. Whereas right now, at least in theory, there's this hard, bright line around torture that every soldier, every interrogator, every intelligence officer knows, every cop knows that he's not supposed to go across. And if he goes across it, it's clear that he's like, doing something he's not supposed to. If there was a system of regulation, then suddenly that hard, bright line is blurred. And it can, I think they will introduce, it will make it much harder for the low-level soldier or police officer who's being instructed to do something that he thinks is morally questionable, to say the least. It will make it harder for him to discern to whether it's appropriate, and it will make it harder for him to resist it, even if he thinks that it's not. Furthermore, I think Dershowitz is largely deluding himself about how much warrants actually, provide oversight or restrain anything. I mean, if you look at his analogy for the system for the torture warrants is the FISA court, which authorizes intelligence wiretaps. And if you look at the history of the FISA court, it has almost never refused a request from one of the intelligence agencies. The judges who end up on this court have a very strong predisposition to trust that the intelligence agencies are going about things correctly. And there's no reason to think that would be any different if they were, allegedly overseeing torture. And, for that matter, as we've seen in the FISA court, just because the system is there doesn't mean that the government is only going to use it. If they feel like, it would be authorized were they to go through the system, then they're very prone to avoiding it when it strikes them as too much trouble. I mean, the whole warrantless wiretap scandal shows that as well as anything else.
FISA is FISA, which is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. A key justification for torture, Christian, is the ticking time bomb theory. There is a bomb that's going to explode. There is no time to defuse it. And we have, the authorities have in custody, the person who planted the bomb and can stop its explosion. And the argument is that torturing this person into revealing where the bomb is will save many, many lives, many innocent lives. And many people see the logic of this theory, this ticking time bomb theory, but you spend an entire chapter picking it apart, and you begin by arguing that this theory makes certain unstated assumptions that are rarely met in real life, such as what?
Well, there's a level of certainty built into the case that is probably very nearly impossible in the real world. So, it's just the person that you suspect of having planted the bomb. It is the person. It's not just, we have to assume that the bomb is there. We have to assume that the bomb works. We have to assume that there's no other way of finding it or defusing it, that there's no time to evacuate the city. There are all of these assumptions which, in order for the thought experiment to function correctly, have to be taken as given at the outset, which in the real world we can't take as given. There's also the main assumption is that the ticking time bomb case is an exception, and that it isn't simply a convenient rationalization for what the authorities are going to do anyway. For that matter, it also makes certain assumptions about the sort of social condition in which the social circumstances in which this is happening. It assumes that basically it's a government that has legitimacy, that has respect for human rights, that isn't, straightforwardly racist, that isn't pursuing the anti-terrorist campaign as part of a larger, campaign of aggression. There are a whole array of sort of idealized assumptions built into the case, which really, in the real world, at the very least, we would need to give scrutiny to.
Christian Williams is author of American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination, published by South End Press. His work has appeared in the Columbia Journalism Review, in These Times, and in the collection We Are Everywhere, The Irresistible Rise of Global Anti-Capitalism. His next project involves researching Oscar Wilde's anarchism. Very interesting. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and KPFA.org. My name is C.S. Song. Even if there were a small number of cases, Christian, in which torture is morally defensible, you still think that all torture should be prohibited. And I want to ask you why, and I think this plays into your contentions about coercion and the extent to which states, well, the relationship of coercion and the operation of a nation state. Why shouldn't we give the state discretion to allow torture in certain circumstances?
There's the moral reason, first of all, that even in the case where it's perhaps defensible, it isn't justifiable. And it may be that the consequences of not doing it are so severe that they provide a sort of mitigating factor. But the act itself is so atrocious and so much involves using another person merely as a means to your end that I don't think it could ever meet the standards of justice. Aside from that, there are very practical matters, such as torture has proven to be very hard to contain. I mean, the idea of the Guantanamo experiment was that they're going to authorize it in a few cases by specific units against certain targets in a particular location. And as the military's own investigations have shown, that sense of approval very quickly traveled outside of the constraints that they meant for it to have. Furthermore, we should think about the sort of things that institutionalizing torture commits us to as a society. You know, it means that we need to train people in using torture. It means we need to have manuals on how to do it. It means we need to have policies on when it's appropriate. It means we need to have oversight to see if the policies are being followed. It means that we need schools in which to train people. It means that we need facilities and the tools that will actually be used to do it. And all of this is, those things can't just be worked up at the moment when the hypothetical ticking time bomb is already there. They have to be put there in advance, and they aren't going to go away when the emergency passes. And, the logic of a bureaucracy is always that for an organization to survive, it has to be used. And so the investment that goes into sort of the torture infrastructure then becomes an incentive to use those resources and to use those techniques.
It's kind of like military might, for example. Christian Williams, in his book American Methods, writes, "Torture, once authorized and embodied in an institution, almost inevitably becomes a standard procedure." Tell us more about coercion, because if torture is, as you say, of little use for intelligence gathering, then what is it good for, and how does control and coercion come into play?
It's good for terrorism. It's good for breaking down the individual's will to resist, and it's good for frightening everybody who knows that happens. And the it's often less important that the things that the individual victim says are true, then that the state can demonstrate that it can make the person say them. So it doesn't necessarily matter if they're sincere in their denunciation of their comrades or their renunciation of their ideology or their fantastical confessions to, you know, imagined plots. Like, the truth of that doesn't make much difference. What really is valuable about it is that the state demonstrates that it can make the person do it. And so that isn't just bad for them. It doesn't just, you know, damage their own sense of their own integrity and worth and all of that. It also is very corrosive to their social ties, to the solidarity of any social movements that they're part of. It breaks down trust among the people that they've worked with or organizations that had any sort of tie to their organization, and it terrorizes anyone who might consider resistance because they're afraid of similar treatment.
Can states, Christian, can they operate without coercion? How integral is coercion and mass control to the normal operation of a nation state, especially one as powerful as the U.S.?
Well, coercion is what states are about. I mean, they are in the business of coercion. And, I mean, pretty much by definition, the state is a set of institutions which seek to determine public policy and monopolize the means of legitimate force. I mean, coercion is what they are for. And that's part of why they use torture. Torture happens to be it's an extreme of the kind of thing that they do already. So, you know, it isn't necessarily it doesn't necessarily require the government to, you know, change its overall sort of mode of thinking in order to reach for the tactics of torture. It already really follows from the logic that goes into running a state in the first place.
And we're also talking about human nature. You mentioned the Milgram experiment earlier. In 1971, researchers constructed a simulated prison on the Stanford University campus. The subjects, all student volunteers, were randomly divided into prisoners and guards. What happened, and what should we conclude from this about the need to limit or prohibit torture?
Well, what happened is that conditions degenerated very, very quickly. Within hours, the guards were bullying and tormenting the prisoners. And within 6 days, it had reached such a point that the experimenters were very concerned and canceled the experiment. And this experiment, unlike the Milgram experiment, has not been deliberately reproduced for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit hard to know exactly what conclusions to draw. It has been unintentionally reproduced in military trainings that were intended to prepare soldiers for the experience of capture. There isn't the same level of sort of scientific certainty there. The thing that I think theoretically it's hard to know, you know, how to generalize from these cases. Practically, I think the lesson is that it's not a good idea at all to leave some people in the total control of other people. And that if there aren't very clear and very substantial checks in place against this kind of abuse, then it's almost certain to happen, regardless of the particular character or characteristics of the individual people who are involved.
I want to read a few statistics, you might say, from Christian Williams' new book, American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination, which you can get more information about by visiting againstthegrain.org. As of the writing of this book, at least, there have been about 300 reports of abuse in Afghanistan, Guantanamo, and Iraq. That number has no doubt gone up. The U.S. government is believed to be holding prisoners in at least 39 overseas locations. At its maximum, Guantanamo held more than 700 prisoners from 44 different countries. More than 230 soldiers and officers have faced court-martial or administrative discipline relating to abuse since the beginning of the Afghan war. And we should say that this book, in addition to what we're talking about, contains a lot of other information, including the torture of people right here in the U.S., of Abner Louima, by New York City police officers at a police facility. He was arrested outside a Brooklyn nightclub on the night of August 9th, 1997. About the Humboldt Five, where Humboldt County Sheriff's deputies and Eureka police officers used Q-tips to put pepper spray directly into the eyes of 8 nonviolent protesters in 3 incidents in 1997. A number of other incidents and outrages are documented in Christian's book. On the question of empire and torture, I'd like to bring up Israel. Israel is the single largest recipient of U.S. foreign aid. To what extent, and we don't have a lot of time here, and I want to get to your point about smashing the state as a way of attacking torture, but to what extent has the U.S. enabled or encouraged Israel to torture its enemies, such as the Palestinians?
It's hard to overstate the American influence there. In addition to the funding, there's also been the diplomatic cover, which is very important. I mean, if you look at the record of U.N. Security Council resolutions calling on Israel to follow in various forms international law, the United States, being a permanent member of the Security Council, also has a permanent veto, and you can, just read the, one veto after another. Of course, there's also the United States' role as sort of a global leader, being able to very selectively decide whether or not international law is relevant, and by and large, it's just exempted Israel from any considerations about, the Geneva Conventions on the rights of people living in under military occupation, or the clear non-proliferation treaty, or just you name it, and the U.S. has held Israel's hand in going through this process.
And in some cases, you document the correlation, a connection between an increase in U.S. aid to certain countries and certain dictators and an increase in the use of torture by those governments. A few minutes left. You write, Christian, that you can't eliminate torture without smashing the state. What do you mean by that?
Well, going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, torture doesn't arise by accident. The state uses it because it's a source of coercion, and states are in the business of coercion. The experience of international law and the experience of looking at the abuses that persist domestically, regardless of what the laws say, really demonstrate that laws are not enough to guarantee rights, and that if we really want to eliminate torture and not merely limit it or force it into invisibility, we need to go about dismantling the institutions that are responsible for maintaining it. I mean, I was talking a little bit before about, what a society commits itself to when it institutionalizes torture. And the thing that I probably should have said then was that, in fact, we have all that stuff. In fact, we have the concentration camp, and we have the torture school, and we have the torture manuals, and we have all that stuff. We have the institutions that perpetuate it. And, you know, as I said, once those institutions are there, the very investment in them requires that they be used. And the, you know, it follows from that, that if we want them to stop being used, we need to disassemble them. We need to take them apart. And the institutions that I'm talking about are really the coercive arm of the state. So things like the police, the prisons, the military, et cetera.
And as long as those institutions are still there, what role can political pressure play in at least limiting the use of torture?
Well, it can play some. I mean, the government still needs things from the population in order to do what it does. It needs a certain level of support. It needs people to, you know, taxes, and it needs people to join the army, and it needs a certain amount of resources that only the population can provide. And, you know, as popular support goes down, it becomes harder for the government to do the sorts of things that it wants. And, you know, also the U.S. government needs to maneuver and cut deals with other governments. And so it is also subject to international pressure, less so than basically any other state, but some. And the, you know, the upshot of that is that it is embarrassable and it is pressurable. And so it's the fact that ultimately we need to disassemble these institutions that are responsible for atrocities doesn't sort of get us off the hook of doing what we can to firm up international law and maintain the system of checks and balances and, you know, document abuses when they occur and publicize them and, you know, put immediate pressure for limiting the abuse right now. Because, you know, really, if we don't sort of keep both of those aims in mind, then we're, on the one hand, very likely to only engage in sort of half measures and never get to our objective, or we're very likely to feel like the objective is so far distant beyond what we can achieve that it's not even worth pursuing.
We leave it right there. Christian Williams, his books include Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. We've been discussing his latest tome, American Methods, Torture and the Logic of Domination. Thanks so much, Christian, for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And this is CS suggesting, as Albert Einstein once did, that the important thing is not to stop questioning. And Jen and I will look for you on Monday.
Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Sung with associate producer Jen Angel. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you can download audio and find links to show-related resources. We welcome your comments and suggestions by email at againstthegrain@kpfa.org, or you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670.
And thanks to Sally Phillips, who is at the controls.
Hear Ronnie Gilbert read from her memoirs, Charlie Varon perform from his play Rabbi Sam, and Sandy Tolan speak about his award-winning book, The Lemon Tree. Plus, awards to Israeli peace activists Anat Beletsky and Jeff Halper. Saturday night, April 28th, 7 p.m. in Oakland, a benefit for Jewish Voice for Peace. As part of the conference, Pursuing Justice for Israel-Palestine, Changing Minds, Challenging U.S. Policy. For info, go to jewishvoiceforpeace.org or call 510-465-1777. You're listening to KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, and KFCF in Fresno. Online at kpfa.org. It's 1 p.m.